My guest this week is Taylor Weaver in the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. Taylor is from Texas and he came to Canterbury in 2014 in order to do a PhD in religious studies at the University of Kent. And we find out why from early in his life he tried to conceal his Texan accent, and he talks about the culture shock of coming to the UK. He talks about the traits that he inherited from his parents. He talks about getting into a fight when he was young and why he once claimed that the devil told him to drop a boulder on his brother's head. Why it was never possible as an American living in the South to escape religion. Why there is a confessional dimension to his studies. Why he isn't representative of most Baptists due to his liberal worldview. He talks about the paradox of being radicalized by leftist intellectuals. We discuss the value of education in overcoming ignorance. Taylor talks about the music that he grew up with, listening when he was young to Lynyrd Skynyrd, why he is now embarrassed to admit that he used to listen to particular forms of rap. We talk about playing video games, going into academia, the teachers that inspired him, extracurricular activities that he was involved with at university, where the Taylor's memories are predominantly positive, why he wishes that he could go back to his undergraduate days again, why his parents' divorce was a character-building experience, and how he wanted to be in the Marines and even dreamed of becoming a rock star. So, rock star extraordinaire, Taylor Weaver, is my latest guest. My name is Chris Deasy. Welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. Well, it's a pleasure to meet Taylor Weaver this afternoon. And Taylor, we've known each other for, I'm guessing, about 3 or 4 years.
I think, four, because I came here in 2014.
And as your accent would betray, you're not from this side of the pond, as it were.
I am not. I am from the United States of America, and I'm from Texas, although I don't really have much of a Texan accent.
So did you lose it after coming to Canterbury?
Oh, no, I've never had much of one. It's been one of those things where when you grow up in the South, often, you know, Southern accents are seen as uneducated and, you know, a bit backwards. So I learned early on to try to hide it a bit. Although I do notice that I have changed my accent a bit since coming here, and my wife thinks that I sound a bit more British, but, you know.
Is that a perspective that you had over in the United States? Is it non-Southerners in the United States who have that perception, or is it a perception that you sensed from within your community in Texas?
Generally, non-Southerners seem to, or at least the perception of Southerners is that non-Southerners look down on them, and the accent sort of betrays the sort of cultural area they're from. And so while a lot of people take pride in that and take pride in the South, and I did as in some ways as a young child, as I grew older, I tried to hide it more, because you kind of notice in media and stuff how Southerners are treated as a bit daft.
Well, it makes me think of the film My Cousin Vinny. I don't know if you know it, which plays on Joe Pesci and Marissa Tomei, set in Alabama. He's from New York, and of course he doesn't fit at all, both in the way because he's sent to prison because he's not dressing properly as a defender, and the Grits come to mind there, and you know, and I think the verdict hinges on how long it takes to make grits, which is an Alabama specialty, and you know, it plays rather well on the whole, you know, urban New York versus southern redneck, or whatever the term that they use there to refer to that part of the world. But yeah, we do things differently. Alabama law is not what you're used to in New York, man. So, yeah, but on a suit and a cloth, you know, cloth and tie. But so is Texas where you were born?
No, I was born in this. Well, I'm originally from North Carolina, same place as my supervisor Ward Blanton. He's from there as well. But I grew up for most of my life in Texas, or at least a good, before I came here, I was there for a good probably 12 to 15 years or so.
And you came here then 4 years ago. Did you notice any really big changes? Was it your first time in the UK when you came here to study?
It was my first time coming here, yes. Big changes as in like the differences between the US and the UK. For sure. And I didn't think that I would have any culture shock, but I definitely did. Kind of the way that people approach you, the differences in taste in regards to food and things like that. There's one thing that like pops out clearly in my mind. It was like maybe the first week that we were here, and my wife and I like wanted to go out to eat somewhere because, you know, we're in this new place. We want to experience British food and whatnot. And so we went to like this, I can't remember, it's by the Greyfriars Garden, like this little restaurant, or rather big restaurant actually, connected to, I think, a hotel. We went and we ordered stuff, and everyone was sort of reticent towards us and seemed a bit hands-off. And then when we were done, we were waiting for the bill, waiting for the check to come, and we just waited and waited and waited, and we were there for so long, and no one ever came. Finally, like, I plucked up the courage to, like, wave over the waitress, but we didn't realize that, whereas in the U.S., you have the waitress or the waiter come over to you constantly and always asking you how you're doing and cheerily, you know, talking you up and all that kind of stuff and asking when you're done. It's a bit different here. Quite a bit more hands-off. And so it was just one of those awkward, weird moments where I noticed things are a lot different.
I think it depends where you go, because I've been in restaurants where they do come over all the time. But I certainly noticed that in America when I went there in 2002, I think it would have been. And I was conscious that in the hotel where we were staying, they were coming over all the time. And at one point, they even put the napkin, you know, properly around my neck and, you know, under the shirt. And I thought, this is... And then I was... A few minutes later, they came back and I thought, God, this is good service. And then they put a little note saying, for our international visitors, this is how we do gratuities over here. And I felt very awkward because it was clear that there was a service being offered. And so this is what they did. It was very hands-on, but there was the expectation then of reciprocity. And of course, you also have a tip culture here if you're at restaurants.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I never quite got the hang of it in America because I was never quite sure, particularly in hotels sometimes where like some hotels might have like a courtesy car or a limousine maybe, and it's all free. But of course, there is an expectation that you give something, but how much do you give and what sort of percentage? You don't want to be to give so little that it's offensive, or again, you want to give so much that you end up, you know, being strapped for cash by the end of your holiday. So maybe you saw things from the other side when you came here.
Yes. Although, you know, coming from the South in a very small area, like the town I was in, about 25,000 people, 23,000, so very small, you know. You would encounter tipping at the restaurant, but that was about it. You know, no other, you know, moments would you really tip someone. So, you know, if I went and there was a limo or something that was free, I wouldn't have no clue how much to tip someone. So,
that's the whole thing. It's the fish out of water, isn't it? It's being a visitor. And also, I guess, being in a big city as well, where they're expecting that. And, you know, if I'd gone to a different part of America, it may have been a different sort of culture and a different set of expectations. But actually, what you said about the restaurant does surprise me a little bit, because I'm certainly used, certainly when I was growing up, or, you know, when I was at university in West Wales, and you'd go into a small shop that sold, say, electrical equipment, or I just wanted, maybe in those days, I wanted to buy a pack of video tapes, or, you know, something just ordinary. And as soon as I walked in the door, it was, can I help you, sir? And sometimes you almost forget the reason you went in, but you might have just gone in to browse. I'll have a look at the latest televisions or just see what audio technology you've got. But, you know, sometimes it's nice to browse without the requirement to purchase. But sometimes when somebody asks you, you almost feel that unless you've got a clear answer, you're trespassing. That was my perspective anyway. but that isn't something that would happen in the same way in the city. So we probably have the same sort of dynamics afoot depending on where you go and visit. But you've been here 4 years now, so you probably will go back to America and it'll take you a while to work out again, you know, what you once took for granted, and now you see things from a different perspective. But tell me a bit about your background in terms of what your parents did.
My parents divorced when I was pretty young, when I was in kindergarten, so around age six. But my dad worked in power plants. So when I was young, he worked. We lived in Arkansas, and he worked in a nuclear power plant, and he was sort of a technician. He would fix things that would go wrong. And after before my parents divorced, they actually bought a pet shop, And so I lived by a pet shop for a while, and my mom just sort of stayed at home. She was a stay-at-home mom. And then they divorced, and my dad, he continued working at the power plant, but he would go to different power plants, and we relocated to Texas when we did that. He was working in a natural gas power plant. So that was mostly his background, is kind of he grew up on a farm and did a lot of working with his hands, and he actually traveled the country a lot working at different, you know, mines and power plants and doing engineering stuff. So, he liked to travel. Not so much these days, but, yeah, he really enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm. Do you sense that you're doing something very different in that sense? Obviously, the travel bit is something that you've certainly done in coming over to Canterbury, but quite a few of the people I've interviewed as part of this series on nostalgia have commented on how they may have had parents who worked in industry or in construction or in factories and didn't have the same sort of educational background that they have. And so in that sense, there's been, you know, first generation university, that sort of thing. Is that something that happened in your case?
Yes. I mean, my dad, I believe, if I'm correct, has an associate. So he did have some, which, you know, is beyond high school kind of education. But my mom didn't. In fact, I could be completely wrong, but I don't think that she finished high school. She may not have finished everything in high school. So in that sense, I am sort of breaking away from the norm. My dad's a very intelligent man, and, you know, I guess I got that from him. He's very critical and skeptical about some things, and so I think I picked up those sort of traits. But you know, he also is well-meaning when he says these sorts of things, but he will kind of play up the Southern trope of talking about how, you know, education, you know, liberal arts and all that kind of stuff is a waste of time. Meanwhile, you know, here I am working in religion and theology, and I think that fits into the waste of time category, even though he's a religious guy. But yeah.
What about earliest memories? How far can you go back? What can you remember from your childhood? I mean, I can go back. I can remember being at nursery, so I would probably be about 3 years of age. And I have some very early memories that I can't necessarily locate. I couldn't tell you which year it was, for example. I can certainly remember my first day at school, but how far can you go back? Do you have any particular memories that you sort of think, you know, that have stayed with you over the decades?
Yeah, it's weird because sometimes, you know, you don't think about these things all the time, but then when you get asked about it, they kind of pop up. But I do have some really early memories from, you know, around the same time, like 3 or 4. Like, I remember getting in a fight. I went to a Montessori school, which I don't know if you have those here. So it's kind of, it's like a preschool or nursery school, but it's kind of formed around alternative ways of learning. So you do a lot of cleaning. Like, children will clean, or you may have, like, specific objects to work with. You make pottery, you make soup. It's a lot of, like, sort of learning through playing, through doing. And I remember this little girl gave out a bunch of invitations for a party, for a birthday party, and she gave me one, and then this kid came up to me and said, "That's mine." I was like, "No, it isn't. She gave it to me." And he slapped me on my face, and I fell on the ground, and they're like, it was like a cartoon or like a TV show when you see a kid's thrown down and like a ring of students just forms. It was the same sort of thing. Mm. And so I remember very clearly, like, laying on the ground after getting, like, slapped by this other kid. And there's other weird memories. I remember being in a church and seeing a picture of, like, white Jesus and being told, "That's God." And I was like, "Oh, that's God?" Like, and then, you know, being told that this is his house and wondering, which is his bedroom, you know, and kind of a strange, like, memory where I'm sort of just kind of, I guess, pondering, like, the meaning of, I don't know, this place being a place of worship or whatever, and this idea of God, and not understanding anything about sort of it being, you know, an immaterial being or anything like that, but thinking it as very physical and seeing this picture and thinking about, you know, sort of God in this sort of physical way. I remember dropping a giant rock on my brother's head one time.
Good heavens.
Apparently all the memories I have, or many of them, are violent. You know, getting slapped. And this one, my brother was sitting in a cardboard box, and he was learning the Greek alphabet for some reason. He was, like, reading it or reciting it. And I just came up behind him with this giant, like, boulder-sized rock and just dropped it on his head. Like, I don't know why I did that.
And the consequences of this?
I got in pretty big trouble.
But also for your brother. Was he okay?
He was not very happy about it. It didn't hurt him too bad. You know, as a you know, 4-year-old, it seemed like giant, but I'm sure it was quite small.
So it's interesting that the first three memories you have, one involves being the victim of violence, one is the perpetrator of violence, and the other is meeting God for the first time.
Well, interestingly, when I was the perpetrator of violence, the reason I did it was because there was another young boy who was at the, this is when we had a pet shop. He was at the pet shop, and he told me to do it. And he, like, sort of egged me on. Mm. And so after I did it, I blamed it on Satan. I said, the devil told me to do it. And so it's interesting how that sort of, I don't know, religious aspect is still there. That this is sort of a memory where I'm blaming a sort of religious actor or a theological being or whatever on my perpetration of violence or something. Mm. So, yeah.
But I went to a church school. And I do remember every week the local vicar would come over and talk to us. And there was always this point of disconnect because we were very young. And of course, not least in terms of the costume that was being worn, that this was not the everyday. And then we were told about things that we didn't really understand. And he spoke in a language that was way above our comprehension. And of course, we'd sing, you know, there'd be hymns that we'd sing in assemblies. We went through the motions sometimes, and I'm not sure we ever really understood. And I think that, for me, is probably why I ended up studying theology at university, because it was in the case of saying something momentous was going on, or something that was like a break from the norm, or there was something, this was presented as a significant moment. We have somebody coming in, giving us religious instruction, we must take that seriously. It's about our moral and spiritual welfare. And I probably just wanted then to unpack that and almost sort of do what I often do with films. You know, the films that I didn't see when I was younger, you know, go back and revisit them as an adult. Perhaps I was trying then, as an adult studying theology, to try and understand the things that I missed the first time because I wasn't ready for it. I wasn't prepared for it. But I wonder if you had a similar sort of journey in that sense. Because obviously, not least in terms of what you're doing now, but religion was part of your everyday. But from what you were saying, there was a lack of, not comprehension, but it was something that seemed very other.
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't, as an American in the South, you can't escape religion for sure. We didn't go to church or anything, but it was always sort of present. I remember we had like a, you know, children's Bible that my mom would read Old Testament stories to us from. Had no idea what was going on, just saw the pictures and whatnot, but yeah, I'm not sure. When I went to a church and I saw the picture of Jesus, it was because I was a part of the Boy Scouts. Do you guys have something similar?
We did. I didn't do that myself, but we had the Cubs and the Brownies, and the girls had the Brownies. Yeah, the Cubs and the, yes, it was Cubs and the Scouts, and the girls had the Brownies and the Girl Guides.
Yeah, so that was the only reason why I was even in a church, was because the Cub Scout meeting, I think, or the Boy Scout meeting was happening there, and so it was nothing even religious. It was like, it was kind of like we were occupying a space that we weren't fully a part of in a way. Perhaps those that went to the church were entertaining the possibility that we would become a part of that sort of landscape. And so, you know, it's a good thing to get somebody in the doors. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, no, well, but it's funny that sense of motivation, though, isn't it? Sometimes that the way in which, without realizing it at the time, little things that at the time when we're really young, we don't understand, we kind of return to. Subliminally, in many cases. I mean, I would never have thought when I was very young that I would end up pursuing a career as a theologian. The church was always something other, but it was inextricably connected to what I did, because I went to a church school and I went to church. But I wouldn't say that I had a clear sense of identity there. If anything, it was the demarcation. I guess it is the sacred and the profane, and the sense of there being something numinous, like something other, something which I didn't feel that I completely got, but also it wasn't something that was necessarily cerebral or comprehensible anyway, which is what the numinous is. So it's but in later years I then channeled all of that through academic theology rather than worship. So church going has never been in my adulthood at any rate something that's played a big role. But in your case, obviously, then you said your father is religious, but in your case obviously you're studying the Bible, you're a I don't know how you'd categorise yourself, a biblical scholar. But in that sense, does the practice of religion play a role, or has it played a role in your life?
Yeah, I mean, in fact, I got into, like most people, and it's a problem in biblical studies, is that there's so much kind of confessional work that falls back into theology and can escape sort of, sometimes, you know, apologetics. I think it's a deep problem. But I did enter into this sort of study because I was religious. I grew up Baptist in the South, which can be a horrible experience when you leave it, because or when you well, maybe not leave it. I haven't left Baptist denomination or anything like that. I'm still considering myself a Baptist in a way, but very different than where I came from, because in the South Baptists are quite conservative in a lot of, I think, dangerous ways. As one can see right now in the political, you know, sphere in the U.S. But no, I wanted to be a youth minister, and so I went to a local university that was close by, East Texas Baptist University, which has a kind of name that makes it sound like a bunch of yokels that don't know what they're talking about. But I left the wanting to be a youth minister behind when I took my first biblical studies course and recognized that this is like something much bigger than trying to teach youth or something. This is about doing sort of historical work. These texts are really interesting, how they were compiled, how they can be understood, trying to extract the different sort of traditions behind how these texts came together. It's a fascinating thing. And these texts are, you know, foundational elements of our culture. Even now, and, you know, even, you know, in England, you know, less than half people are religious, it's still sort of like a foundational part. You can't like escape the sort of religiosity in a way, and these texts in a way either. And so, yeah, there were times where I really questioned my religiosity and my Christian past, and there's still a lot of difficulties with it. And it probably wasn't until maybe the last few years that I would even call myself a I struggle with calling myself a Christian and embracing it. And I don't really like to talk about it too much. In fact, many of my friends don't know that I am, because I just don't talk about it. Because I don't want to appear as if I'm someone who's trying to propagandize or something like that. But yeah, I've retained that aspect, or I came back to it.
It's often awkward, isn't it? The context in which we give away something about ourselves. And you can stand up in front of a class of students and talk around matters, intellectual matters of faith. You can go into a lot of detail about what particular theologians have thought and what their impact is. Or you can talk about political matters in the right context, or, you know, depending obviously on, you know, the environment in which you're talking. But you can go outside your comfort zone. You can be in the supermarket, you can be on somebody else's turf, and then that innocuous question, are you a religious person, has a very different, or warrants a very different sort of answer because of the change of context. And almost the I always think that when I'm at the supermarket, the person who's sitting at the checkout has far more power over me than I have of them. It's their turf, that's their job. Yes, I know they say the customer's always right, but I'm a guest in their environment. Whereas when I'm teaching, I have an obligation to disseminate things, and sometimes I have to make sure that I, you know, teach the curriculum. So if it's relevant to say something, then you have to say it. You're duty bound to say it. But it's interesting that what is perfectly okay to talk about religion on a religious studies program in a university is very different to saying, yes, I believe this or I believe that. Yeah. And often it is, you know, we don't talk about confessional faith with our students, but we will do that often if we're asked outside. And, you know, the students never ask me, I never ask them about their faith positions. But it does come up, say, in the supermarket. And I feel sometimes I end up just talking, gobbledygook because I'm aware of whatever I say. I'm anticipating the answer and how it's going to be perceived. And I sometimes think I don't really want the conversation to go down a particular path.
Yeah, I was terrified of coming here to England because my understanding of Europe as a whole when I was in Texas was that there's like nobody's a Christian at all. Like, if you're a Christian, you're looked down upon as like some subhuman, like horrible person who hates gay people, and you're definitely like super socially conservative and all this kind of stuff. And that's stuff that when I was young, because of the environment I grew up in, yes, I didn't hate gay people. You know, I didn't really have any gay people to hate, at least none that were out in East Texas. But you have this idea of love the sinner, hate the sin. And those are ideas that I left behind when I was in university, as I became, I guess, more radicalized by leftist stuff, which is something you wouldn't expect at a Baptist university, but it's there that I encountered Alain Badiou and Zizek and Agamben and all these interesting philosophers, and Adorno and you know, Walter Benjamin and things like that. And so I had embarked on a tradition that was shaping my Christianity in a different way. I was terrified of coming here because I didn't know how people would think of me. And in fact, it's interesting because at one point, after getting to know one of my colleagues, Sandra, in fact, she told me that when she saw my name and who I was and where I was coming from, she was kind of didn't want to meet me because I was coming from Texas. I was coming from a religious school, so I'm definitely going to be some like redneck hick that, you know, hates everyone that's not a conservative evangelical or something, which I'm not. I'm not like that at all. But coming here, it's quite a bit different. There is more of a mix, and people are much more forgiving and accepting and understanding.
And I was interested actually by the phrase you use, being radicalized by the left, because of course that's the that's the inverse of what we're used to hearing at the moment in terms of the radicalization by the right.
Yeah.
And in your case, you're saying that you were radicalized by intellectuals.
Yes. I suppose I say that sort of tongue-in-cheek, just because it's an odd thing to hear about. I think my past is an odd thing, coming from a Baptist school, a Texas Baptist school, and from this school learning about, you know, Marxist theory. Like, who would fathom that someone at a Baptist university in their religion program would be getting into Marxist theory and like Maoism and reading about these kind of things and interested in like anti-capitalism?
I'm always interested in those debates that happen over, for example, intelligent design, and you know, what are you allowed to teach in the classroom? Are you allowed to teach evolution? If you don't believe in evolution, you don't want your children to learn about it. But the idea then that if you learn evolution, you're going to be, you're going to lose your God-fearing status. You're suddenly going to, you'll renounce your Christianity and worship Satan. I mean, it is a little absurd because it's. I mean, one great thing about education is that whatever happens, you see many perspectives. And when you're older, you're going to be, unless you're in a Truman-style scenario. Well, even that didn't work out for him because he knew there was a world outside, even though he'd never been exposed to it. But it's truly bizarre sometimes how in an educational environment you can learn things and study all sorts of different perspectives, but you grow with that. Well, you know, I say it's bizarre because it's often the perception is the other, that if you expose somebody to something that they're going to then believe in things that you don't want them to learn, but they're going to find it out anyway. They're going to learn it in the playground, they're going to find it on social media, on the television. So education is much more about, well, that's saying, well, these are the relevant sources, these are the theorists that we want to study, and this is your starting point, and it's for you to go off and then challenge that or question that or subvert that or agree with it, but at least do so in an informed manner.
Yeah, it's self-defeating to try to contain in that sort of way. There's this moment, I'm sorry if I'm derailing things or whatever, or ruining any questions. There was a moment before I came here, it was in 2014, I worked for a year and a half, my wife and I did like children's ministry at a church, a little tiny Southern Baptist church, And the pastor, he was kind of a regular Southern Baptist doctrinally, but he did a really good job of, he really cared about the material situation of the people in the area. And he worked really hard to alleviate that and to help people, especially the children in the area who were, a lot of them had parents who were hooked on various sorts of drugs. Meth is really big in the area, and other drugs that can be quite dangerous. But he made me really angry. One day, he was preaching about something and just felt like going on a tangent for no reason about evolution and talking about how they're trying to turn our children into atheists. And when they teach about evolution, they're turning them into atheists. And you know what? If you disagree with me, then stand up and say something about it and tell me that I'm wrong. If I'm wrong, so be it. Tell me I'm wrong. And I was like seething. I was so angry because like, to me, this is just such a terribly reductive way of viewing your own religion, viewing your own texts, these biblical texts, and of just viewing the world. And I almost stood up, but my wife was like, she saw that I was really mad, and she like was like, don't do it, don't do it. So I didn't, but I was like, what the heck? How can you be so great and like try to relieve the material kind of problems of this area and then like shove this like BS down people's throats? Like,
yeah, so on a different level though, and in a way a less serious level, because it was more about me than the culture I was in. But I remember being at university and knowing that one of my tutors in particular had written on near-death experiences, life after death, and he had a particular perspective. And there were, you know, there were materialist perspectives, and then there were the perspectives that said that, you know, we can entertain the possibility of the supernatural. And I always felt that whatever I wrote, I wanted to make sure that he didn't read it and think, oh, I don't agree with that. And it's funny, that perception that I wanted to please, I wanted to say the right things. Whereas I say to my students now, don't be afraid. In fact, actually, rather than just present work or write essays that is, you know, a clone of what I think, it's good to challenge that, and you will be rewarded. In fact, actually, if you can make me think differently, then we've all benefited. Then that really is education in action, rather than the hierarchy of me saying, you know, if you don't believe this, then you're going to fail. You know, you're not going to get a good essay mark if you say anything that disagrees with what I think. So. Yeah, but it is funny that those perceptions in a wider cultural context, yeah, can be quite poisonous, really. Anybody growing up who's then afraid to speak their mind, yeah. But in a way, the fact that you've made it over to Canterbury, in that sense, you've physically changed environment, and I guess in that sense, at least, you're able to cultivate, not least through having decided with a particular supervisor and a particular research project to do what you want to do on your terms, and you've literally travelled halfway around the world, yeah, in order to accomplish that. But not everyone would have that same opportunity or luxury.
Yeah.
So that's fantastic. One thing that I am always interested in asking anybody is what sort of music they grew up with. And for me, the charts played a huge foundational role, the music charts, in what I was listening to and what, you know, we used to share in the playground. Had our favourite song gone up or down? Was it still at number one? Was it being played on the radio? Did you have any sort of similar interest like that growing up? Did music or pop music play a particular role in your growing up?
Not in the same sense. Music was a big part of my life and still is. I grew up not really listening to much radio. My dad would listen to country, some of the country stations, so, you know, country and western, which I was never really a big fan of, but he did, when I was really young, get my brother and I into the southern rock band Lynyrd Skynyrd. And so my dad had like this special, you know, this is back in the 90s, so it was, you know, really like, you know, technologically advanced what he had in his truck, but it was like a CD changer where you have like a cartridge of CDs and you plugged it into this thing and you could on the radio press, you know, and switch between CDs. And so, you know, instead of listening to the radio, we cycled through different discs, and a lot of that was, you know, things like Lynyrd Skynyrd. And
yeah, the only, is it Free Bird?
Free Bird.
That's the only one I know.
The song, because it was too ballady, and I'm not a fan of ballads, but they had, I guess, 7 or 8 records that they put out. My dad had seen them live, and so that was a big part of my childhood. And then I got into a lot of terrible, really crap music. like Insane Clown Posse, which is terrible. It's the worst ever. Please, I feel embarrassed even to admit. I'm glad you don't know what it is, because I'm embarrassed to even admit that I listened to it. Terribly vulgar, misogynistic rap. It was just crappy and dumb. But you know, when you're young and you have an older brother, you know, that's kind of the thing that happens. But then I got more into, as I got older, kind of progressive rock and post-hardcore music and sort of post-punk and stuff that nobody cares about or listens to much anymore.
But would you say your musical tastes have evolved? Do you still listen to the same music? I mean, obviously not the one that you just mentioned, which we won't name again. Rewind. But yeah, but do you find that any of the music that you grew up with still lingers? You know, for me, I'm often in the car. I'd love to have what you mentioned there about the CD that changed, because I'm normally having to sort of set it very carefully. I've got only the one CD drive, and I have to make sure on long journeys, if there's nobody accompanying me, to make sure that I have the next CD ready to go, sticking out of my CD box, so I can then press eject and you know, insert the other one in, you know, on a straight stretch of the road. But I sometimes hear songs that I listened to many years ago, and then it does all sorts of things to me. And also, it's a good memory jogger. So music, you know, and it's actually quality proof. I'm not saying that all the music I grew up with is any good, but because it was such an elemental part of my growing up, it's important for those reasons, rather than a simple case of, oh, it's good quality stuff. I mean, not all the stuff I mean, Kids from Fame comes to mind. High Fidelity, I loved all that sort of stuff. And why not? Because these days, it's okay, because Fame are back. The Kids from Fame, I think they're going on tour, because apparently it's the UK audiences, the fans, who've requested this. And I used to watch that programme on Thursday or Friday night, whatever it was, after Top of the Pops. So it would have been Thursday night when that's going on. But all that sort of stuff. But somehow, like with ABBA, when I was at university, ABBA always seemed to be a little bit of a sort of, you know, has been bad, a little bit naff. And then after a few years, by the end of the 90s, not least when Mamma Mia the Musical came out, it was the biggest thing on earth. And they're like, you know, the biggest band ever. Well, one of them, as is Queen, I guess. But yeah, so music does a lot of things for me, but does it play the same sort of role in your life?
In a way, whenever I hear some country and western songs, even though I don't really like them, I know them for word, and it brings a sort of like, it brings back memories of like riding in the truck with my dad. And same with Lynyrd Skynyrd, and I still like them. I think they're very, they wrote fairly, in some ways, fairly complex music, and really interesting stuff is going on there, even though, you know, the lyrics are kind of crap, but whatever. But stuff that I listened to when I was a teenager, when I hear it now, it reminds me of very specific moments, like playing video games with a friend. I have very vivid memories of playing video games with one of my friends and listening to this album over and over again. And we're not, me and that other fellow aren't really friends anymore. We had a bit of a falling out. So it's kind of a bittersweet memory, remembering just having a friendship like that and just being able to hang out. But yeah, it definitely does bring up these sort of moments. And they're all good moments, even if they're, you know, kind of remind me of a failed friendship or something.
Well, we'll no doubt come back to some of those wider questions there about the way we integrate the past later. But what inspired you to enter academia, to do a PhD, and who knows, assuming you may or may not want to pursue a career in this vein, but you came all the way over here. What made you want to get not just the PhD, but the first degree as well? What made you want to move into higher education?
It was a thing you did, right? I mean, my undergrad started in 2007, and it was close by my house, and I had a girlfriend, so we're close to my town. And so I thought, you know, I want to be a youth minister. That was my goal then. And if I want to do that, then I need to know how to relate to people in a good way, in a complex way, and be able to help them deal with their problems. So I went into psychology to do my master's in my bachelor's in psychology. But then I changed because I took that biblical studies course, an Old Testament course. And I decided that actually is much more fun learning about like these texts and stuff than doing psychology. For what, you know, maybe that was a terrible reason. But yeah, that sort of propelled me on. And maybe I was always good at school, and I wanted to impress my professors, and I liked them personally, and so that sort of made me want to go on. And then I realized that I really enjoyed this enough that maybe I want to get a PhD. Like, I decided that in my bachelor, you know, work, in my first degree. And yeah, it was just sort of, it was the goal. And when I was able to do teaching, when I was able to experience that, I recognized that I enjoyed doing it. I really liked teaching. I liked engaging students, and I liked being taught. And I noticed the importance of being taught and being formed by these people that knew what they were doing. And so I wanted to be able to form others in good ways. And the other aspect of it, coming over here and doing a degree with Ward, was because in my master's, I got to know the works of these people like Alain Badiou and what they were doing with Paul. And I kind of had this naive idea that I could change the world with my scholarship, and like, that's something you can do, that I can like figure out the formula to like break down all the bullshit. Sorry. To like, you know, all the problems that are going on in the world. I mean, this is after this collapse of you know, the housing market in the U.S. and this terrible recession. And, you know, this is right at the beginnings of Occupy Wall Street. And so I have these ideas that I can become engaged in this, and I can figure out the way, the guide to change things, to change the world. And that's probably also because of, you know, a background in theology. You think that these sort of maybe high-minded ethereal things. But anyway, I'm not going to change the world. No one is ever going to read my my PhD.
Yeah, I remember being a bit naive when I had my first book published, which was my PhD thesis. And I perhaps naively thought that because it was a book, that it was going to sell like books do. But yeah.
Could be the next Harry Potter.
Well, I joked with people that if I was to put the word Harry Potter in the title, or A Brief History of Time, because that's the most read PhD, when Stephen Hawking's PhD thesis was put up, I think it crashed the system, didn't it, at the University of Cambridge. Sadly, that hasn't happened with screen Christologies. Not yet, but I'm hoping for...
Isn't it one of those classics that, like, in 50 years, you know, it'll be like selling like hotcakes, you know?
Well, we live in hope. Yeah,
hopefully not in 50 years. Hopefully,
no, you know, no. 15 or 20. Well, yeah. Well, actually, there was an embarrassing time once when you get royalty sometimes, and you know, just in case you or anyone who's listening is thinking of pursuing a career here, 1 year I think I got a check for, I think it was either £9 or £11. It was either just below or just below, or just after 10. And I think I worked out that it probably cost me more money to actually make my way down to the bank and cash in the check. So it stayed in my bag for quite a few months. I almost forgot about it. Then I thought, well, it seemed almost rude. You know, actually, to be fair, it was, you know, legitimately mine, but all the same.
Yeah.
But then again, you know, I never really wrote it for the money. That would be the worst thing, I guess, if I thought that somehow I wouldn't need to teach anymore. I'd just, you know, wait for the money to roll in. But yeah, Harry Potter, that's the route.
Well, you see, next thing you need to do is you need to write one of those, a very brief introduction to on screen Christologies. I don't know. And something to do with like Christ in cinema or something. I don't know. Jesus figures.
Well, it's funny, isn't it, that sometimes accidentally authors, you know, don't necessarily know what the winning formula is, but. Yeah, but maybe one day I'll crack it. Maybe I'll publish all my diaries or something. But what about teachers then who inspired you? Because you mentioned that, you know, there were teachers who were standing in the front of the class and they really, I don't think you used the word galvanized, but that's my word. But it sounds like there were some particularly impressive tutors without whom perhaps you wouldn't be where you are today.
Yeah, there. Yes. I mean, I can't even begin to come close to, I guess, noting how important someone like my big mentor was a guy named Jeff Holloway, who, you know, it's not like he's some well-known academic or anything, but he's a Pauline scholar, and he's written a lot of things, and he taught the course on philosophy at our university on Christian doctrine, and he did a lot of Paul stuff, Paul courses in our master's work. And, yeah, he interacted with Nietzsche, with Paul Ricoeur, with all these, with Badiou, with Agamben, all these figures that normally I wouldn't have encountered. And he's been a source of inspiration. And his big thing is one of his loves is teaching ethics, but he doesn't teach ethics in a way that is normally taught in especially Baptist institutions, because he follows in the sort of Hauerwasian tradition. He's a big fan of Stanley Hauerwas, and you know, and so I sort of grew up on that and MacIntyre and that kind of thing. So he was really important, and then the head of the department was a really important teacher for me, who very different than the other guy, Jeff. He's sort of a wisecracker, and his favorite thing is Seinfeld, and so he sort of like used a lot of those tropes in his teaching and things like that. But he also did my wife and I's our wedding. He officiated that, and we used to house sit for him and dog sit for him. But he was always, you know, even if he didn't understand my work or really know what I was talking about or care or whatever, he was always like urging me on and pushing me and. He really pushed me to come and do this as well, to do the PhD. So he was both really, really great, great men and good people.
And I think it works both ways as well, doesn't it? Because if it wasn't for them, yeah, you know, you owe a lot to them. But also they can be really proud that the teaching that they did lead to somebody making a decision or, you know, was inspired to follow through and fulfill their dreams. So in a way, yeah, they are facilitating that. And I went to a wonderful school, but I do remember a lot of, particularly in religious studies, some people thought, you know, well, why are we doing this? It's a waste of time subject. And it's awful, really, because I do feel that the teacher's role is to facilitate, and that sometimes, even if you're not finding something terribly interesting, well, that in itself is part of the educational journey, and it's how you respond to that. You know, sometimes you can just say, well, you know, I just don't engage with this, so, you know, it's not for me. But I think of the disruption and, you know, people I went to school with sometimes who thought it was perfectly all right. You know, they were bored, so they would make it disruptive for everybody else. And that's cruel.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, okay, they were bored. Well, there are things you can do. You can, you know, it wasn't cool, maybe, to engage. Well, that's their problem. That's something about their relationship with their friends and their biases or ignorance, whatever it is. But, you know, looking back, I do get a bit angry sometimes when I just think that, you know, somebody didn't like something, so they wanted to spoil it for everybody else. And I think for that reason, it's funny you mentioned bands, but for that reason, that I don't know whether it was therefore because I was happy to embrace stuff that wasn't, inverted commas, cool. But of course, even down to musical tests, you'd sometimes have to be careful what you said you liked.
Yeah.
The first record I ever bought, or had bought for me, because I was only 7 or 8, was Bucks Fizz, which was the, you know, British band. It was a Eurovision Song Contest winner from 1981. And for many years, I always felt embarrassed about saying that. You know, these days, who cares? I was 7 years old. You know, great stuff. You know, it won Eurovision. Every, you know, Eurovision is a bit trashy, but also it's terribly popular, and then it's done as sort of guilty pleasures that people have. But it's sad, really. It was, you know, almost as though I couldn't completely talk about what I liked because I was worried that people would laugh at me. So I think, you know, we have to be really, and certainly for my own children, I say, you know, just go with it. But what about other things that happened at university, whether it was sport or film or politics? You know, was there anything going on that, as well as the academic study, that was particularly influential for you?
Not so much. When I was in high school, I went to a small high school, and so that extracurricular activities were really important to me. I did poetry interpretation, which was basically kind of acting out a poem, but there were certain stringent rules about what you could do and could not do. I did theater. I was very big into theater. We had a really good theater troupe that won a lot of awards, and I did, you know, cross-country running and some track. And those were really important to me, and I still have the medals somewhere at home. Not that I would ever pull them out ever again or really care about them. But when I went to university, it was like, I think I was tired of doing all this stuff. And I also like realized that, I don't know, I didn't have enough time, I felt. I probably did, but I really cared more about socializing. And that was also a time when video games were becoming more and more cool, and the video game Halo was really big, which was like a first-person shooter game, and you could play that with lots of groups, like large groups of people. And in our dorm, we could hook up straight into the wall. Everyone could hook their Xboxes up into the wall, and you could play like these massive, like 30 people battles. And so that kind of became my extracurricular. I hate to admit, I don't really play much video games now. And I was always like an A student, so I was able to do that and also, you know, get my work done. But that took away the time that I could have been, you know, playing intramural basketball or doing theater or something. So,
But I used to find that there were lots of clubs, you know, people would be involved in different societies. And yeah, I don't know. And I think also sometimes you've just got to find your own feet authentically.
Yeah.
And it was only in later years, certainly after I went to university, that I developed an interest in film. And I did towards, at the end of my undergraduate days, they used to run a trip down to Swansea, which is where the nearest cinema was, or the nearest multiplex was, in West Wales. And we used to go down there sometimes on a Thursday night, and I remember watching, we were going to watch Pulp Fiction, but when we got there, it had all sold out, so we ended up seeing, I do remember, it was a film that had one of the Baldwins in it, and it may have been called Threesome, but I think it was Stephen Baldwin.
One of the ones no one cares about.
Well, yeah, and it was, we ended up seeing that film because it was the only film left that had any tickets left. But anyway, there we are. But no, cinema started, it was something that started to evolve around that era. In terms of some of these sort of more philosophically based questions, would you say, going back over your whole life, that your memories are predominantly positive?
I'd say it's a mixture. Because my parents divorced, there was a lot of I think angst, a lot of bad stuff that happened with that, a lot of really bad stuff. So a lot of that, it's taken a long time to exercise those out of my psyche or whatever. I'm using terrible language. Mm-hmm. Probably very imprecise language to say what I want to say. But like, my mother wasn't the best mother when we were young, and now we're close. But it was very difficult to bridge that gap. But still, you know, I have memories of bad things my mother did, and those sort of bad moments. Now, when I think about high school, those are all good memories, like all positive, amazing. University, no problems. Like, when I think back through that time, it was just like the best time of my life. I wish I could go back to undergrad because it was just so much fun. Like, and I loved my friends, and I got to see them every day, and had the best roommates ever, and we would do fun things like go to downtown and climb abandoned buildings and sort of break in, you know. We wouldn't steal anything, these were abandoned, but you know, it was a lot of fun to just sort of like explore, do this sort of urban exploration.
I think you've now just answered my previous question.
Yeah, I guess that was one of my extracurriculars. And I played in a band, and like we did a tour back when I was in undergrad, one tour, put out a few records, and that was a lot of fun. Those were sort of my extracurriculars. So nothing close with like official university stuff, but lots of other things. So,
but would you say it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences? Or is it the interpretation of negative experiences? I mean, it's interesting that you answered my previous question by referring to your parents and the divorce. But I guess in a way you'd say, well, that wasn't a good period, but then what followed was, and then what you know, at school, but then after that again at university was even better. So there's a contextualization that, you know, that you can't sort of look back and sort of say, yeah, it was all great. Of course, there are peaks and troughs with everything, but in terms of character building, I guess, for example.
Yeah, I think so. I think like that's dead on. And in a way, it was kind of like started really low and then went, you know, higher and higher, rather than just like a terrible moment and then good and then another terrible moment and then good. But yeah, I think going through the divorce was definitely like a character building thing. And I had to learn forgiveness through that. I had to learn how to forgive my mother. I had to learn had to forgive my father. I had to learn, you know, how to operate in a household that didn't have a mother. And I think that, you know, helped me learn a lot of things about sort of getting up and going and just doing what needed to be done, and, you know, helping the household and kind of giving when I didn't want to give. I felt a lot of that, but I think that when I look at myself also as a father now, because I've, you know, as you know, I have a, gosh, he's 9 months old now, a 9 month old son. Thinking about the bad experiences and how they turned into good, and seeing my father be a good father and take on the role of two parents, I think it's been good for me as a father and stepping into that role. Yeah.
I remember one colleague of mine here, now retired, who said when I first met him that he preferred being a grandfather to being a father, or that he's a better grandfather. Of course, and he joked that, I can give the children back. But I don't think he was joking. And I think that's, but that, there's some truth in that, that you almost sometimes get a second chance, maybe. It's like, well, through being a grandparent, it's maybe a chance to possibly do things differently with age, in a different context and a different perhaps perspective on how things developed in life. Age sometimes can bring wisdom.
That's
really inspiring. Well, what about that question of whether you fulfilled the dreams you had when you were young? Because I can't imagine that when you were growing up you thought, I'm going to be in Cat. Well, of course, you're at the beginning of your, you know, you're very young, and with the answers you were giving about Xboxes and plugging them in, you're clearly younger than me. But what about that question of whether you, for example, entertained thoughts about doing something different with your life that may be in keeping with what you dreamed about doing as a child or at university?
You know, what did I want when I was young? I think so. I think in some ways I have, but not completely. There are things I wish I'd gotten to do. I remember when I was really young, I wanted to be an army man, as I said, because I didn't have the words or the vocabulary to talk about that kind of thing. And I almost went into the Marines when I was in high school, and then I realized that was perhaps not the right route. And so perhaps the dream was never reached, because I recognized that this dream is not that it's unattainable. It was very attainable, but it wasn't actually as, you know, the bubble was burst, and I realized that this isn't something that I would want to get myself into. The idea of taking other lives and contributing to the state in the specific way that would call me to do. And when I was in university, while I wanted to go on and be an academic, I wanted to play music. Like I, not that I was like the best guitarist or anything like that, or you know, some amazing musician, but I entertained this dream that we could make it, that we could get signed, and that we could, you know, tour, and I could still do the academic stuff. I could still, you know, read the books I wanted to, and, you know, maybe sort of write academic papers, but my main job will be, you know, being a rock star or something. And these are unattainable dreams. Like, there's an infinitesimal, possibility of attaining that kind of thing. And even if you do get signed to a record label, the idea that you're going to make any money with the greed that's, you know, clearly exhibited by record labels, is, you know, it's just, it was a dumb dream. I miss it, and I miss playing guitar, and I miss, like, playing in front of crowds and creating music with friends, but, yeah, I do miss that. I'm really nostalgic about that. I wish I could still do that. I miss it so much.
No.
But
are you still in touch with friends from your past?
Yeah, I've, you know, it's so hard when you're so far away, but there are a few that I text. My old roommates, one of them was the best man at my wedding. He came and visited me here back in 2015, and we took him to Dover, and we went to London and hung out. So we're in touch, and a few of my friends that I was in a band with, and you know, the people, and, you know, with Facebook, it's hard not to be in touch. But, you know, yeah, you can have 1,000 friends on Facebook or whatever, and all of them you know, but distance starts to creep in, and after a while you don't know these people anymore. And so I'm in touch with a lot of people, but not not really, you know.
Yeah, and for me, the important thing is to meet people in the flesh, as it were. Oh, that yeah. Facebook, in a way, is a means to an end. That it means that we all have busy lives and we're no longer able to do the things that we always promised that we would do at university. Yeah, let's see each other all the time. We'll always meet up, and of course you never do because you end up in different parts of the country, you have families. But sometimes it is wonderful when there is still that point of connection after many years or even decades, and you realise that there's a reason that you were friends with them. They haven't changed, you haven't changed, and you think, yeah, you know, that's the way it should be.
Yeah, I'm sure like going to Lampeter, right, for you, really sort of like solidified that idea that, wow, you know, these people I was friends with, I can reconnect with them.
And I have done. And if there was a period when I wasn't, it was A, because the technology wasn't there. We didn't have Facebook and we didn't have each other's addresses. But also just life situations that sometimes we move in directions. I saw the Freddie Mercury biography recently, but you know, we all go through periods in our lives sometimes when we fall from grace, or we fall out of favor, or we lose touch with the people who matter. But if you can come back and be reconciled, yeah. Very Paul Tillich in there. But I think that can be something that you cherish. And I have reconnected with so many people in the last year that it feels sublime. I feel this immeasurable sense of gratitude. And also that sense that, and authenticity is the word, that these were real friendships. Yeah. Not just, you know, I'm not saying that was the case in all of them, because I haven't reconnected with all of them. But in some cases, I feel that the bonds are still there. We have enough in common and that will sustain us. We may not see each other very often, but when we do, we know that these are priceless. And I will never forget that. My last question, Taylor, is would you consider yourself a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
That's a profoundly difficult question, isn't it?
I saved the best to last.
Yeah. That is such a hard question. Everything's obviously grounded in the past. You can't get away from it, but I'd say I'm more of a looking forward type person. And that causes certain anxieties, of course. You know, it can be a very hopeful thing, but it can also be a very anxious thing, especially, as we all know, as academics. And especially, you know, someone in their early career who's about to have Reviva and all that kind of thing. There's this, like, okay, you've always got to be thinking about what you're going to do next. What am I going to work on next? What is the next project that I'm going to try to complete? What's the next article that I want, that I can crank out quick enough that I can have something on my CV? Because, you know, if I don't have enough on my CV, nobody's going to hire me. So there's a lot of looking forward, but it causes anxiety, and it's due to anxiety. It's hard actually to stay in the moment, because all I'm thinking about is what am I going to do whenever I finally get the PhD, and how am I going to provide for my family? You know, the market's so terrible. What am I going to do to sustain myself and, you know, us while I'm trying to land a, you know, job in academia? So looking forward, but I mean, it's not all terrible. It's not all anxiety. I mean, there are things that, like, especially having a son, like thinking of him growing, seeing him grow, like seeing him like trying to stand on his own now, and like just thinking about, like, he has 6 teeth now. Like, what is his face gonna look like when he has all of his teeth and he starts to lose his baby fat? Like, who is this person? And watching them emerge into the future is something really exciting. And also, I mean, it's not like, it's terrible. It makes me sound like I think of academia as this thing that you have to like crank things out. I don't think that. Like, I enjoy what I do. I enjoy doing research. And so I'm excited, and I do look forward to continuing research and ideas and little things, that projects that I'm working on. So I'd say I'm more of a looking forward type person, as far as I can tell. Mm. Other people may answer that for me differently, but...
Well, it is so wonderful to catch up with you. And thank you, Taylor, for a very inspiring conversation, actually. I think we covered a lot of ground, but brilliant to catch up with you.